Good morning, everybody. Welcome to NTWC Live for Wednesday. It is July the 20th, and we're just sitting here talking about drought in Texas right now. We're all dry as can be. Look out the window. My grass is green. We're about 70% normal rainfall in my part of Texas, but that's not the norm. Today, we've got Jeff Masters on, Dr. Jeff Masters. Fascinating program coming up today. I can't wait to get into this conversation. I think it's going to be good, and all of us have a ton of questions, and I know those of you watching at home or at work or online have questions as well. I want to thank the folks who make this program a possibility. Of course, we also want to thank all the sponsors, USAA. They've been with us from the very beginning. And USAA, we appreciate your support of this program and all we do at the Storm Science Network. The South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau. The South Padre Island is the host for the National Tropical Weather Conference every year. We'll be back there again in April. We invite you to join us in person if you can. Keep watching for registration information here on Facebook and on the various websites for the event. The Weather Company, the City of Brownsville, Weather Boy, Black Magic Design, the Port of Brownsville, and Walmart. All sponsors of this event, and we appreciate each and every one of those organizations that make these events a possibility. Of course, this also gets turned into a podcast, so you can hear us on that podcast as well. With us today, Dr. Hal Needham, also with us, Bill Reed. And Bill, let's start with you to get a little bit of an update on what's happening in the tropics now. I have a sense, Bill, that may be a quick update today.
Yeah, we're having a July kind of like what you expect in hurricane season, kind of a soft lull before the main part of it.
Yes, we just want to say thank you to get all those sponsors, in particular USAA. You know, USAA, Bill, you're a USAA user and a client for a long time, and they've just been so valuable to what we have done here from the very beginning, because when we needed somebody to step in and make this possible, they were there. And Bill, you can vouch for how good they are with what they do.
Okay. We've had our guest this week, we've had on before, and we'll probably talk again about his life-changing experience with Hurricane Hugo. But earlier this year, there was a lot of conversation about a loop current being a little bit more noticeable, maybe a little bit warmer in that. And we really didn't have anyone lined up to talk about it. And Jeff's been so kind to join us with that. Jeff, we know him from the tropical and the meteorology, but he's got a lot of interest in all things weather, and he's up in Michigan now. Many of you would know him as the founder and the successful developer of the Wonderground online service that, back when those sort of things didn't exist, became a go-to place for a lot of us. So, Jeff, welcome to our show.
Well, thanks, Bill.
Yeah. So what about this loop current? Why is the loop, what is it and why does it exist?
Yeah, why does it exist? I saw that question in your initial salvo of questions and said, okay, scratch my head, why does it exist? Well, it exists because of the general circulation of the atmosphere, the winds of the planet. Because we live on a rotating planet, they happen to set up various bands of prevailing winds. In the tropics, in the Atlantic, you have the prevailing easterlies. They blow east to west. And then at the mid-latitudes, up by, you know, the 30, 40 degrees north latitude, you've got westerlies. So that combination of winds drives a clockwise rotating current system where you have got, through the Caribbean, a very warm current of water flowing from east to west, being driven by the trade winds. And when that water piles up on the coast of Mexico by the Yucatan Peninsula, well, guess what? There's a little opening there, the Yucatan Channel, and so that warm water goes squirting up through there. And at that point, it doesn't have much room to go anywhere, so it ends up curling around and going through the Florida Straits and then up the east coast of the U.S. as the Gulf Stream current. So this very warm current of water, it's got some of the warmest waters in the entire Atlantic, from the Western Caribbean into the Gulf of Mexico and then through the Florida Straits. That very warm current of water extends down to almost 2,500 feet. And it's about 100, 150 miles wide, something like that. So a great flow of very warm water coursing through the Atlantic Basin.
Interesting. And I always thought I understood these currents as kind of like on a scale of the large ocean is kind of like a turbulent feature where energy builds up along the main current and breaks off in the form of a swirl that comes away from the standard flow of that. Does that still make sense?
Yeah, that's right. It's interesting if you look at the sea surface anomaly plots, that is the difference in temperature from average, you can really see these turbulent eddies that break off from the loop current all along its course, particularly off the coast of North Carolina, New England. You'll see, you know, these little counter-rotating eddies that are always breaking off. And of course, in the Gulf of Mexico, we've got a very important eddy that tends to break off that we're looking at now.
Mm-hmm. Is there any predictive skill, like how it's going to evolve and change with that? And if so, how far in advance do you think we can do that?
Yeah, it's kind of like trying to forecast the weather, but on a much slower scale. I mean, the oceans are very slow to respond, and you can make a successful forecast of loop eddies, and there is at least one service I know of that generates these forecasts. You can probably go out, you know, a month or so in advance, maybe longer, but the loop eddies are driven by winds, so that, you know, if you've got an uncertainty in what your winds are going to, you're going to have an uncertainty in what your ocean currents are going to do. So in a large sense, your forecasts of the loop current and the loop eddies are not going to be very high skill going out periods of weeks to months in advance, just because we can't forecast the winds that far in advance.
That's interesting. I suspect it's easier in the summer where the prevailing winds are fairly light and not changing that much due to the big subtropical highs versus the winter passing fronts and all.
Yeah, and you've got the MJO, that periodic burst of tropical activity that goes through, and that's hard to predict. So that throws another wrench into things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sure you've seen this too. Sometimes we will see a storm cross the loop current, and the intensity will react to it positively. We'll get an increase. And then there'll be other times, other storms I've seen where it's not really noticeable to me that anything happened when it crossed it. Why is that the case, do you think?
Hurricanes are fussy creatures. You got to have everything just right for it to be able to take advantage of what would be seemingly favorable conditions. If you've got a strong upper level wind regime creating high wind shear, it doesn't matter what the ocean temperatures are below that hurricane, it's not going to be able to do much with that extra heat energy. So the only times you really see a hurricane exploding when it crosses the loop current is when it happens to have everything else going for it. If you happen to have light wind shear, if you happen to have moist air in the mid-levels surrounding the storm, you can't have a big, you know, influx of dry air from the Sahara, for instance, impinging on the hurricane. So if all those other conditions line up, then it can take advantage of that nice warm water in the loop current or the loop current eddy. Mm-hmm.
What do you think, at least in the more recent years, what comes to mind you of storms that most dramatically intensified upon crossing the loop current?
The most famous one was in 2005. Hurricane Katrina really put the loop current eddy and the loop current on the map. People really didn't appreciate the importance of deep, warm waters in the Gulf of Mexico for hurricane intensification. And when Katrina crossed Florida and moved out over a very substantial loop current eddy, then it exploded into a Category 5 storm. And then 3 weeks later, following a very similar course, Hurricane Rita did the same thing. That loop current eddy was still there, just displaced a few kilometers further to the west, and it also exploded into a Category 5 storm. So those two are the first, you know, progenitors of this whole awareness of loop current eddies. And more recently, Hurricane Harvey back in 2017 moved over an old loop current eddy that had broken off over a year previously, but it was still present off the coast of Texas, and that helped fuel Harvey into a Category 4 storm. And the other one that comes to mind is last year, Hurricane Ida crossed over a loop current eddy and just bombed out into a 150-mile-an-hour storm, the strongest on record ever to hit Louisiana.
Yeah, I've often wondered if the great Galveston 1900 storm may have done something like it. His path would have been statistically likely, if you're going to have a loop current, that it would be. And it, when it entered the Gulf, it was a nondescript tropical storm. So something happened between there and south of New Orleans.
Yeah, I think Camille in 69 as well, and probably Audrey in 57, all these, you know, rapidly intensifying hurricanes, you know, right before landfall, were probably taking advantage of a loop current eddy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that Harvey thing, how long will when a breakaway eddy like that occurs, how long will that eddy be recognizable in the Gulf?
Up to a year, maybe a year and a half. Actually, if you look off the coast of South Texas right now, about 200 miles offshore, the loop current eddy that fueled Hurricane Ida last year is right there. It's moving slowly westward, about, you know, a couple, maybe 3 mile per hour, and it'll probably dissipate later this year as it goes into the continental shelf waters there by Corpus Christi, Brownsville.
Wow. See, I've been telling Tim all season that this is his year to get whacked.
Uh-oh. Stop it. Just stop it now.
You got another factoid in there. Can you think of any examples of storms that we thought might become big storms that crossed a loop current eddy and didn't really do anything?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I can't. I should have looked that up beforehand, but I'm sure there's a bunch of cases. I can remember maybe back in 2000. I'm not really sure about that question. How about you, Bill? Do you remember any storms like that?
Yeah, I only know of one because it was my first big landfall when I was director. It was Gustav.
Oh, Gustav.
Came off of Cuba, still had good structure, and everybody was huddling around it. The ship's guidance was robust with it. And I remember everybody saying it's going to go right across the loop current. And only 3 years after Katrina, and Rita, as you pointed out, the memory was there. We were forecasting regenerating from a Cat 2 back to a Cat 4, and it was moving fairly quick. And that may have been part of the reason, but I actually think it ingested dry air, as you pointed out earlier, and we did not see that in the data leading into it.
Yeah, I remember the passage over Cuba seemed to rough it up more than we thought, too, and it never was really able to regain its inner core.
Yeah. This, I like the way you describe it, that these ocean features are there for the taking, but only if it's the pristine condition of the storm, that there's other factors that are more dominant, I believe is what you say.
Yep, absolutely.
I'm going to turn Hal loose. He had a bunch of interesting questions. Go ahead, Hal.
Well, Jeff, how often does the loop, like a warm core eddy, break off from the loop current and drift towards the west? I mean, would that happen in general, like annually or even multiple times per year?
Yeah, it's something like between 9 and 15 months, you'll see one break off. The last one to break off was the one for Hurricane Ida last year, so around August. And looking at the maps just the past week, it looks like one has now broken off. Looks very similar to the case of Ida last year, similar location, similar intensity, similar size. So we got a repeat of the conditions that we had last year in the Gulf.
And one of the concerns here as well is that these loop current eddies would bring seaweed as well for tourism here. That's a huge economic impact. And so a lot of the seaweed I know is coming up on the loop current, and the concern is a warm core eddy could break off and bring seaweed with it as well.
Huh. The Sargasso weed, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Because I know it was really bad in the Yucatan this year, and it's been a concern here on the Texas coast. Will we get an eddy break off and, you know, bring some of that loop current water towards us?
It seems like it would not do that because the eddies rotate clockwise, which means that it would rotate that seaweed into the Gulf Coast of Florida much more likely than over towards Texas.
Yeah, good insights. Fascinating to learn about the loop current. Jeff, I wanted to ask you another question, not exactly with the loop current. You've done so much weather and climate journalism so prolifically for so many decades. I mean, I'm wondering if there are stories that, or anything that's really surprised you in the weather and climate science that you've covered, like something that you got into a story and you said, wow, that's not at all what I expected to find.
Yeah, I've been a meteorologist 40 years since I got my degree in 1982. And things kind of went, you know, according to what I expected my first 20, 30 years of my career. But yeah, just since about 2010, it seems like the unexpected has become normal now. And now when people ask me, you know, does anything surprise you? And I'm like, no, there's no normal anymore. It's all just craziness. And the one thing in particular that's the most important thing I've seen that nobody expected, particularly not me, is the jet stream behavior. We're seeing cases where the jet stream gets in these very contorted positions where you get these really sharp ridges of high pressure right next to intense troughs of low pressure, and it stays stuck over the same areas of the world, locked in place in these really extreme configurations. And this is driving a lot of the increase in extreme weather we've seen. For instance, the floods last year in Europe and in Germany and Belgium that caused over $20 billion in damage. A lot of the heat waves that we've seen in recent years have been due to this sort of phenomena, like last year's really ridiculous heat wave over the Pacific Northwest. And in particular with that heat wave, this is another thing that really boggles my mind. The whole rainforest in Washington state last year during that heat wave, they had 110 degrees. And I never thought I would see, you know, the whole rainforest, a location only 2 miles from the coast, experiencing 110 degree heat. And their previous record high was 99. So we've just been blowing away all time records in some of these heat events, like yesterday's heat event in the UK. They hit 104 degrees. In multiple locations, 34 locations broke the previous all-time high for the entire country. That level of extreme heat is something that has been a surprise to me, but probably shouldn't have been. If you look at the way global warming happens, okay, you shift the temperature a half a degree Celsius or so to a warmer climate. You wouldn't think that would cause such a big effect, but if you look at the bell-shaped curve of what the normal temperature distribution is, it's those tails, the extreme events, the ones we care the most about, those, when they shift, it really causes a massive increase in extreme events. So for instance, a 1-in-100-year event now becomes a 1-in-20-year event. So you've now quintupled your odds of really, really extreme conditions. And that's what's most important. That's what we're seeing a lot of now, is the tail end of that distribution has shifted. And boy, it sure has been exciting and terrifying to be a meteorologist this last 10 years.
Yeah, we've been ever since Harvey, and at the same time when NOAA came up with their updated return frequencies of different timescale rain events, a lot of debate is where we're going with that, because what used to be a 100-year rain event, which is, you help calculate a 100-year flood event, is now a 50-year event here. And the debate is whether that'll keep going that way, or we don't know.
Yeah. One other event, Hal, that comes to mind that boggled my mind was the fires in Australia a couple of years ago were so intense that they sent a giant plume of smoke into the stratosphere, which caused ozone destruction. And there was also fires in California the last couple of years that have done the same thing. First time on record that fires have been so intense that they've done stratospheric injection. Now, so far, we're not seeing that that's causing a problem with, you know, increased UV reaching the surface, you know, increased destruction of ozone being a big problem. But that's the kind of off the scale, unpredictable event I did not see coming. And the fact that, you know, I really don't want to plan a vacation anymore in the Western U.S. just because I know the wildfire smoke's going to be horrid. I did not see that coming. The ramp up in intense fire activity has been extraordinary in recent years.
Jeff, and it sounds like you're saying what's exacerbated this to some degree is these systems being locked in place, like a ridge of high pressure locked in place, maybe a trough locked in place, and then the jet stream in these strange configurations for a long period of time.
That's right. And those locked in positions are contributing to what we call marine heat waves. They called it the blob. A few years ago, a really intense warm area of water developed off the Pacific coast of the US and just stayed there for months and years, and they helped contribute and helped reinforce the jet stream to stay in this extreme type of configuration where a ridge of high pressure remained locked in place over the western U.S., contributing to their mega drought, which has now drained Lake Mead and Lake Powell so that we almost can't provide power anymore from the hydro generators there.
Jeff, do any scientists or modelers predict these patterns, you know, how much they may get locked in place and where they may get locked in place?
Yeah, there's a couple of good groups doing work. And in fact, Michael Mann and company put out a paper last year or the year before, I don't remember which, showing that part of the reason that these amplified jet stream patterns have gotten worse is due to fine particle air pollution. So that if we manage to stop burning so many fossil fuels, not only will it reduce climate warming due to less CO2 going in the air, but it will also reduce the amount of particle pollution in the air. And this will feed back to jet stream behavior and reduce the extremity of the sort of, you know, big excursions we're seeing in the jet stream. So now we've got multiple reasons to stop burning fossil fuels. We'll not only reduce the heating, but reduce the incidence of these extreme jet stream patterns.
Yeah, that's interesting. Michael Mann was on our show a year ago, I guess it was, from when we were down at Padre Island doing it remote. And he also had a study just finished on the impact of less aerosols leading to more hurricanes.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's why we saw a relatively quiet period in the Atlantic in the 70s. Is because there was so much aerosol pollution over the waters there from North America, suppressing hurricane activity. I mean, less sunlight was reaching the water, allowing less heating. But since the Clean Air Act helped clean things up, then the thought is that, yeah, in the 90s, you know, this active hurricane period that began in 1995 might partially be due to the fact that we were good and reduced the amount of air pollution.
Yeah. I'm getting tons of questions online. So let me throw some of these in here because a lot of the viewers are asking questions. So I'll start with Peter Black's question. You know, Peter.
Yeah. Peter and I flew on the Hurricane Hugo flight you wanted to hear about.
And we will talk about that and maybe have some comments to go with that. He wants to know about, and back to the loop current, he wants to know about Hurricane Opal in 1995. He said that was a wake-up call. When rapid intensification happened with that as it approached the loop current and then the Gulf Coast. Any comments on that?
Yeah, Opal was kind of a forecaster's nightmare because here it popped off of Mexico and rapidly intensified to a Cat 4. And the original forecasts were thinking, you know, maybe Cat 2 at landfall. And here you had this massive evacuation order at the last minute ordered for the Florida Panhandle. A lot of people caught on the roads and couldn't get in shelter. And they have this Category 4 hurricane bearing it down on them. Well, fortunately, after Opal moved off of the loop current eddy that was powering it, it weakened. And it did not hit at Cat 4. Otherwise, we could have been talking about, you know, an epic disaster.
This direction of a storm moving across the loop current matter, east to west versus south to north or southeast to northwest? Does that make any difference? Maybe time over the loop current, if anything?
Yeah, it matters insofar as the shape of the loop current. So if you're traversing a longer portion of it, then yeah, it would matter. But and I think if you've actually got the warmest waters to the right front side of the hurricane, that is the most beneficial for it. At least one modeling study showed that. I'm not sure how other modeling studies have done it. It might be a case-to-case sort of basis. I'm not sure any generalities can be made.
Casper wants to know if the ENSO region of the Pacific has any impact on the orientation or strength of the Gulf loop current.
I don't think so. But again, I'd have to see research on that.
Right. There's so many of them here. I'm trying to scan through and see everybody here. Can you, another one from Peter, can you comment on the huge heat content maps on isotherm? There's a whole long, I don't know if you can't see it, but can you comment on the huge heat content maps? I don't know if you can without looking at it. I don't know if you know what he's talking about.
Well, certainly if you look at the total ocean heat content that's in the Atlantic right now, it's actually a little bit less than last year in the Western Caribbean, so less potential for rapidly intensifying hurricanes there, about the same in the Gulf of Mexico. But if you compare it to, say, 2005, we are so far above 2005 when we had, you know, Hurricane Katrina and Rita and Wilma all bomb out. So a lot more heat energy available in recent years compared to previous years. And oceanographer Nick Shea has an interesting theory that maybe global warming is causing an increase in the amount of heat energy in the loop current in the Gulf of Mexico in recent years. But that's not for sure what's being observed, but it's something to watch for going forward.
I'm scrolling again. Let's see. Does this year's loop current break off in the Gulf make an Ida, like rapid intensification, more likely? And wind shear has been low for weeks in the Gulf. Is that expected to continue as a seasonal pattern is rather stuck in place?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter that much if you've got a loop current eddy in the Gulf versus the loop current itself. Both have extremely deep, warm water. And if you've got a very contorted pattern like we do now, the loop current moving northward and then an eddy right on top of it, that's very conducive for a hurricane to rapidly intensify. Looks a lot like last year, looks a lot like Ida. So if we have a similar disturbance coming out of the Western Caribbean this year, I would expect rapid intensification would be, a above average probability. And as far as the seasonal outlook right now, maybe you, Bill Reed, have some comments there about what kind of dry air and wind shear patterns are looking like in the coming few weeks.
Well, I was going to add Phil Klotzbach, who I follow most of the seasonal stuff on, begins his 2-week forecasts. He doesn't start those till I think the 3rd of August this year. So it's the beginning of August, but in general, we're in a La Nina pattern. So the wind shear should be less than average, certainly less than in an El Nino year. A lot of dry air. The strength of this dome of high pressure that gets, kind of a feedback loop with the heat we've got going on there is probably going to be a wild card, see what that does. And I don't know how to forecast that beyond what a couple of weeks shows us right now. So I think it's a little too soon to get too cocky about what August might bring.
Yeah, the water temperatures look near average across most of the main development region from the coast of Central America to the coast of Africa. A little bit cooler than average, maybe in the eastern Atlantic. So it won't be an early starting Cape Verde type season, it looks like. Maybe mid-August, that's about when things usually heat up. And I think climatology will start, rearing its head then, and that's when things are going to pick up.
Do you recommend any websites to track the loop current? Is there any place good to see it?
Yeah, there's the Navy has a website with their HICOM model, HYCOM, that shows you, they have an animation going back an entire year showing the currents as they swirl around. It's kind of cool to watch, the eddies, tear off and then slowly move to the west towards Texas. I recommend that site. I did a post at Yale Climate Connections a couple months ago where I have that link in there. And as well, I have a link to Nick Shea's site at the University of Miami, which shows you total ocean heat content maps. And you can call up historical data. And there's a couple other sites that have heat content maps as well.
We'll try to find some of those. We'll post them here so folks can keep up with them so they can see what's going on. A lot of great questions coming in, but Bill and Hal, let me go back to you guys because I know you had a ton of them as well. So Bill, what else you got?
Since Pete Black's on there, we'll get him all excited here. There's probably a lot of people on here that haven't heard your story of Hurricane Hugo. So I wouldn't mind hearing again. You flew out of Barbados and a lot of, like a couple other storms we talked about, we weren't expecting it to intensify rapidly. Our skills improving on that, but back then it was almost zero on the rapid intensity. So take it from there.
Yeah, we had a 2-plane mission scheduled on NOAA's P3 Hurricane Hunter aircraft. And we were flying out of Barbados, and we had a forecast for Hurricane Hugo to be a Cat 3 when we got out there. And it's always a little bit difficult proposition to gauge the intensity of a hurricane that no Hurricane Hunter aircraft has been in before. And that was the case with Hugo, because it was coming across the ocean from Africa, too far away to fly into. So we were going to be the first plane out to meet it. So we had an estimate of its intensity only from satellites. And as we know, satellites are good, but they're not perfect for measuring hurricane intensity. A lot of times you'll get a Hurricane Hunter plane in there and it'll be off a whole category from what the satellites were thinking. In the case of 1989, we were worse off than usual because one of the GOES birds burned out and we only had one. So normally there's two GOES satellites in the air, one over the eastern U.S., one over the western. But now one of them burned out. So that meant we had to move the other one in a compromised position halfway, which meant it had a very poor look at the eastern Atlantic. It could not really look straight down on the hurricane to measure its, you know, warm core to see how intense it was. It was looking at a very oblique angle. So it came up with a Cat 3 estimate. So we planned our mission thinking we're going to come out and see a Cat 3. We were pushing the envelope of safe flying that day. We wanted to fly at 1,500 feet, which is much lower than you usually fly a hurricane in. And normally you fly 10,000 feet, particularly in a Cat 3. It's very rare to fly below 10,000 feet. But we'd gotten away with it the previous week in another hurricane called Gabrielle, flew at a Cat 3 at 1,500 feet. And it's important to gather data down at that low altitude because that's really the key to understanding hurricane intensification, is the interaction between the storm and the ocean at low levels. There's a lot going on there we don't understand, and we really want to get good data down there to make better hurricane intensity forecasts. So that was the goal of this mission. And we got out there flying at 1,500 feet, and our sister airplane was up high at 10,000 feet. And there was a third airplane coming out as well, an Air Force plane that was just there to help out the Hurricane Center with reconnaissance. But we were the first ones out there, the low aircraft. And right as we approached the hurricane, our radar crapped out. So we had no view of the storm. So we orbited for a while trying to fix the radar. And during this time, we were blind. We didn't really have a very good picture of, you know, are the satellite estimates any good or not? So finally, we got the radar fixed and we were behind schedule. So we were in a hurry to get into the hurricane. So we popped in first spiral band at 1,500 feet. And I got a good look at the hurricane on radar and looked at it and said, okay, yeah, you know, nice tight eye, 12 mile diameter, looks like a Cat 3 or maybe stronger. And at that point, we were flying in the moat region between the spiral band and the eye wall. And the horizontal winds were pretty weak. They were 50, 60 mile per hour. And we were all thinking, okay, or, well, that's about what you'd expect from, you know, a Cat 3 at strongest, probably. So that's pretty light winds. We're going to go ahead and fly into this hurricane at 1,500 feet. Little did I realize that in our haste to do this penetration, the radar levels on our scan were off scale. They were set to the previous storm the previous week, and they were actually saturating. So we were not getting the full readout of how strong the echoes were from Hugo's eye wall. And in part because of that, and because we were stubborn, we went ahead and plowed into Hugo at 1,500 feet into the eye wall, which was going to take 2 minutes to cross. Once you're in the eye wall of a hurricane, you really don't have much choice to maneuver. It's so turbulent that you've got to just gut it out and make it into the eye where it's calm. You can't really climb much or descend. Well, you can descend, but you don't want to do that. So we were committed. Right away, as soon as we hit the eye wall, we knew we were in trouble because the winds jumped up to 150 miles per hour at flight level. This is a Cat 4. And we're like, okay, crap. We're in a Cat 4 at 1,500 feet. Not good. This plane has only ever been in one hurricane that strong at that altitude. And that was Allen back in 1980, which darn near damaged the aircraft irreparably. Okay, we're committed. So we're going to keep on flying. Now we're halfway through, 1 minute in, 1 minute to go. The winds are increasing even further. Now they're up to Cat 5 levels. And we're like, okay, this is really serious, not good. Now we're starting to get some pretty bad updrafts and downdrafts, about 10 mile per hour in the vertical, and things are getting a little hectic inside. We're hitting zero G's as we rise up, and then the downdraft will pound us down, and we get two G's of acceleration. Well, the plane can handle that, but it's not good for the interior of the aircraft, because things we didn't happen to tie down very well are starting to fly loose. There's a clipboard bouncing around, and one of the guys lost a Coke can, but okay, so far so good. We're still up, and we're still gutting it through. Okay, now we're getting near the eye, and we're getting even more of a roller coaster, where we're starting to hit three G's and minus one G's. This is getting really rough. It's getting on par with the worst hurricane I've ever flown through, a Cat 3 named Emily, the previous a couple of years ago. So finally, right as the sky starts to lighten up and we realize the eye is right there, we hit the most incredible turbulence a Hurricane Hunter aircraft has ever hit and survived. We hit an updraft of 40 miles per hour, followed by a downdraft of 25 miles per hour, followed by an updraft of 20 miles per hour, all in the time span that the horizontal winds go from 170 miles per hour down to 70 miles per hour. So if you want to think about wind shear, that's the definition of wind shear. So in the horizontal, the plane's starting to skid because it's the unequal wind on the tail and the nose in the horizontal. At the same time in the vertical, the plane's doing this sort of thing, bucking like a Bronco. So we hit 5.7 Gs of acceleration at that time. The plane's only rated to 6 Gs. The 200-pound life raft in the back of the aircraft tears loose, hits the ceiling, bends the metal bar up there, and crashes down, missing everybody. Poor Pete Black's computer rips loose from its mount and tears a gash in the ceiling. The ice chest in the back breaks open, and Coke cans and ice are flying around. The engineer's tool chest smashes in the ceiling, breaks apart, and there's hammers and knives and chisels flying around. It's a nightmare inside the cabin. It's a miracle nobody got hit by flying debris and killed. And at that moment, I hear the navigator say, "We got fire coming out of number three." The number three engine burst into flame. And right at that moment, we popped into the eye. So we're at a pretty steep downward. I remember looking down at the navigator, you know, at a, I don't know what angle it was, but it was not good. And I'm thinking, you know, this is how it feels to be in battle. This is how, you know, this is why people pray when they're being shot at. So I'm there, you know, I'm saying my prayers. But right then, the pilot pulls us out of the dive at 800 plus feet above the waves, extinguishes the fire in the number three engine. And there we are in the eye of Hugo at 800 feet with only three engines, not knowing where we are. We're kind of disoriented. There's a big black wall in front of us of clouds, and we're not sure. Is that the eye wall? Is that harmless scud in the eye? So the pilot's got to make a decision to turn right or left. Well, one way would take us into the eye wall. One way wouldn't, potentially. He turns us to the right. It turns out that's the wrong choice. So we're headed right towards the eye wall. And at this time, he's got the right wing down, which is missing the one engine. It's feathered. And the other engine on that wing is starting to get in the red zone because he's making too steep of a turn. So he eases us off from that turn. And now we've put the left wing of the aircraft into the eye wall, and we're starting to get hurricane force winds. It's bumping around. So he says, "Oh, crap." So he tilts us over at a, you know, hard bank angle. I don't know what it was, 25, 30 degrees, something like that. The needle on the number four engine is going in the red zone. And at this time, the navigator says, "Hey, I can see some damage to the number four engine. There's something hanging from it." Sure enough, I look out the window, and there's this, it turned out to be a rubber boot, a de-icing boot that was hanging from the bottom of the number four engine. So we're in a serious situation here. We got one engine out, one engine damaged. We got one wing in the eye wall, but we pulled it out of there. The eye wall was just being skimmed by our left wing for, you know, 20, 30 seconds. And finally, we pulled out into the center of the eye, leveled out the aircraft, and took stock of our damage. So, okay, we're at 800 feet in the eye wall of a Category 5 hurricane, barely made it in on three engines. Now we've got, or on four engines, now we've got to make it out on three. So we orbit the eye for about an hour. putting away all the stuff that had been damaged, tying it all down so it won't fly loose again when we go out of the eye. The Air Force aircraft that was on its way pops in the eye with us. They come in at 10,000 feet, and we ask them to circle down to our altitude to check us out for damage. And the two pilots do this amazing flyby in the eye, a tight eye. It's only a 10-mile diameter eye, which isn't much for a big four-engine turboprop. They do this close flyby where they check us out for damage, and they don't see any extra damage. So we say, thank you, and can you do us a big favor? We want you to be our guinea pig and punch out through various parts of this eye wall and find a soft spot for us. So and they say, okay, yeah, we'll do that. Bravely. And okay, we're climbing to get to our maximum altitude possible to punch out because there's less turbulence higher up in a hurricane, maximizing our chances we'll get out. But unfortunately, we've got three things working against us to try and gain altitude. Four things, really. One is our weight, because we went in heavily loaded. It's early in the mission. So we dump half our fuel in the ocean, and we chuck out all of our probes. That eye was very well sampled. We tucked out, 20 drop sondes, 10 air expendable bathythermographs, several hundred pounds of weight into the eye, $20,000 worth of equipment into the eye, no problem. And then we are also confronted with the fact, okay, it's a low pressure zone. You can't climb very well if you're an airplane if you've got less lift due to low pressure. It was a Cat 5, and we've got 10% less pressure to work with compared to normal atmospheric. Also, we're keeled over at a pretty good bank angle, about 15 degrees. You can't climb as well with 15-degree bank angle. And also, you're underpowered. You're missing an engine. So those four factors together meant we could only get to 6,000 feet of altitude. Normally, that plane can get to 25,000 feet. So we were forced to exit the eye at 6,000. And we asked that very brave Air Force crew to go in and out at 6,000 feet when we got pummeled terribly at 1,500 feet. So they kept an open mic as they went in and out. And we heard their conversation. Okay, east eye wall, don't go out through that. We took 3 Gs. We got bad turbulence there. We'll circle around and try the south eye wall. And then no go, same with that. And then finally, as they approached the north eye wall, we told them, we're just going to have to go for it because we're running out of fuel. We dumped half our load in the ocean. Sure hope you guys find a soft spot on the north eye wall. And they said, okay, well, there looks like there's a weakness in our radar here in the north eye wall. We'll go for it. They did that, and they reported, it's still Cat 5 winds there, but for whatever reason, there aren't very many updrafts and downdrafts. We suggest you try the north eye wall. And 2 minutes later, we were in the north eye wall. We had everything tied down. Everybody was, belted into their seats real good. And sure enough, the updrafts and downdrafts were pretty tame by comparison in that north eye wall. And we barged out into the moat region, and the sun never looked so good. And we flew home the hour and a half ferry ride back to Barbados with our sister airplane covering for us, looking down, make sure we didn't splash into the waters. And they had the emergency trucks for us out on the runway at Barbados in case there was any problem. We did have trouble landing because I think the pilot was having trouble with missing the one engine. And we had a bit of a cloud of smoke going down the runway as the brakes gripped a little too much. But that was it. We made a safe landing. We all got off the aircraft and counted our blessings. And that was my final hurricane flight. I retired after that season.
Yeah, I imagine there were a few Banks beers pushed down there in Barbados that evening.
Yeah, it was funny. I'm not a gambling man, but they have a gambling machine, slot machines in the bar there. So it's my lucky day I'm alive. I'm going to put a Barbados quarter in here. And I pulled the handle, and sure enough, I got enough bucks to buy the pilots' beers. That's all I wanted. Yeah, we were all just glad to be alive there. And those pilots did an incredible job. They are some of the best.
Yeah. Did any others of the crew decide that was the last of their hurricane hunting missions?
Yeah. Terry Schricker, one of the electronic engineers, and Tom Nunn, our radio operator, that was also their final mission as well.
Wow. And the pilots stayed with it, huh?
They did, yeah. And they flew into hurricanes the rest of the year. And we were down to one airplane that year. I was willing to go up again that year, but there was no call for it because It was a relatively quiet year, and we only had one airplane, so plenty of crew.
Okay, fascinating stuff.
Peter Black's living that with you. He's commenting on all the everything you're saying, being part of that crew. And he talked about how the scariest part for him was when you're trying to climb, and every time you tried to climb, the engines would overheat, and you just couldn't get out.
Yeah, I mean, you feel like you're in a prison. I mean, you're surrounded on all sides by this impenetrable wall. And, you know, I'm thinking I could hear the voice of the storm. I mean, it was speaking to me saying, you know, foolish mortal, what were you thinking trying to, you know, go where you do not belong? And I've actually written a fiction novel about hurricane hunting that I'm trying to look for a agent now to get published, where based on this experience, I have the hurricane hunter plane going in and getting in trouble in a hurricane. And it's been a good way, I think, to express to people what goes on these sorts of missions, and teach some science at the same time, you know, through a storytelling type of venue. So I'm looking forward to getting that published, hopefully in the next year.
Did the NOAA flyers, did they change their rules of operation after that for low-level flying?
They sure did. Thou shalt not go into a hurricane at less than 10,000 feet. Category one or stronger, doesn't matter. You just can't go in. And in particular, there's rules about you have to be a little safer flying when you have a full bag of fuel. A lot more stress goes on those wings when you're early in a mission. You got a heavily loaded fuel. As it turned out, that 5.7 G's of acceleration I talked about, that was experienced in the cockpit, which was actually rotating kind of around the center of gravity of the airplane. The wing loading was much less, more like around 2 G's. And that's where you say you've got a limit of 6 G's. So we didn't really stress the aircraft frame that much. They took that aircraft into very extensive system level maintenance that lasted almost a half a year after that. And they found no hurricane related damage to that tough bird, other than the failed fuel controller in the number 3 engine, which was what caused it to burst into flame and flame out.
Yeah, did they think the turbulence is what caused that fuel system to break?
You know, if you look at the official report, it says no, it was just ready to fail. But it seems like an unspeakable coincidence to me that it happened to fail right then during that extreme turbulence.
Yeah, surprised it didn't do any damage to the wings. The Navy's Super Connie that flew into Clio back in the 60s. They got it back to Puerto Rico, and it never left there by air. It had a lot of wing damage internally. The bracing in there was bent.
Yeah, both P3s have been re-winged now. Last year and the year before, both of those aircraft that went through Hugo have gotten new wings. So they're good to go for probably at least 10 more years, I would hope.
Yeah, I think I saw somebody told us, I guess it was Mr. Parrish last year, they should be the amount of flying they do, they should be able to get 15 years out of them.
That'd be great. Yeah. They got another NOAA jet on order. Is that going to happen next year? Do you know, Bill?
23. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah.
But I don't think they're planning on any more heavy aircraft, the P3s.
No, they have a kind of a working group, research group looking into what's next. Okay. It's still a good platform for developing new technologies to put on the planes. And
that's right.
It seemed logical to me to go to C-130s, since that's going to be the workhorse for the routine reconnaissance, develop it on the platform it's going to fly on. But
that's
my area of expertise.
I'm really looking forward to the drones taking over a lot of these duties. I really want to see some low altitude data from drones. I know they had some good drone flights a couple of years ago. And they've got some new models that are coming out. Maybe they'll fly this year. It looked promising.
Yeah, there's a lot of excitement about that. I guess it's still a ways away from where it'll become routine to be able to do it.
But yeah, the drones are expensive. I remember the Coyotes were like $15,000 each, and they were expendable. So that's big buck science. But if you look at the improvement just from one drone flight, they were showing you could get, you know, a significant, you know, few percent, maybe 5% increase in intensity track forecast. So that makes it work.
Yeah, especially the intensity aspect. Anything we can glean that'll improve our diagnosis, and then obviously the forecast aspect of it would be useful.
Yeah, that was great last year to see the intensity forecast nailed for a couple of our rapid intensifiers, including Ida. I mean, that was a tropical depression and the first advisory, and they were calling for it to be a major, near major hurricane within the 3-day window. So that was a real success. And I think some of the, well, just not just the modeling, but some of the data from these improved platforms is helping.
Yeah, and I think we're getting a better, at least a better conceptual model of what causes it too, to help recognize when you're in that potential and taking the step of forecasting at it. The success with Harvey was in forecasting that is it dominoed into the future years of people, forecasters, knowing that they see this sort of thing happening. It behooves them to forecast it more.
That's right. Now, then we had a new model replacing the HWARF model next year called the HAFS. And that should have some improved capability as well to forecast rapid intensification.
Yeah, Frank Marks was talking about that a month or so ago with us. It was interesting. Tim, what you got?
Just a couple of comments from online, and I'll just share those with you. Wyatt Washburn says hello. I don't know if you know Wyatt, but he says to say hello, and he says that he hopes you win the AGW narrative someday. At least many across the pond have awoken to a harsh reality after the heat wave. So he says hello from wherever he may be. He also asked, how scary is it that this heat wave that's going on and all this is happening during a La Nina year? And would we expect El Nino to bring an even larger heat wave to Europe?
Huh. You know, it's interesting. Yeah, this year, 2022, we can expect very likely will be the coolest year globally averaged that any of us will ever see. It's on par to be like the sixth warmest year on record, something like that. But we're due for another El Nino. And the fact it's been bottled up for over 3 years now, I mean, there's a lot of warm water out there in the Western Pacific ready to slosh over and give us a bonkers El Nino year. And that's going to cause some pretty incredible heat waves. The intensity that have never been seen in the globe before when that next El Nino year happens. Not necessarily in the U.S. It seems like in the U.S., particularly in the Southwest and Texas too, La Nina years give you your worst heat waves and heat events. But certainly other parts of the globe, Asia in particular, I'm concerned about next year. If we do happen to get an El Nino event, those tend to be very bad heat wave years, particularly in India, where they tend to cause failure of the monsoon. That's a big concern.
Saw a great meme yesterday that's the father talking to his son, and he said, son, this is the hottest year we've ever seen. He said, and son, this is the coolest year you will ever see the rest of your life, which is interesting perspective. We're running out of time. Let's each do one final question. And I just want to ask about that picture back there. It's Hurricane Dorian. That's the eye and from inside from Jim Eds. And you talked in a blog 3 years ago about we need to have category 6 and category 7, and that would have been one of them. The last 3 years have been pretty active, the last two in particular. Anything to change that thought or to make you even more firm on that idea?
You know, it would be good from a awareness perspective to have a category 6 on the scale, where maybe 180, 185 mile an hour winds are what the threshold would be. But there are so few storms that get to that level. It doesn't make sense really from a operational standpoint to have that category. I mean, a Cat 5 is catastrophic already, so you wouldn't really need a Cat 6 designation. So, you know, I think it's the situation we have now is fine. We can say, hey, this could be a Cat 6 if we had a Cat 6, but I don't think we need to go there right now.
Al, do you have a final thought or final question?
Yeah, Jeff, a quick weather journalism question. You've been one of the world's most prolific weather bloggers for a long time. Do you have any guidelines that you follow, like, you know, a time of the day that you like to do a post by so it gets picked up by the media? Anything you can, you know, any advice you can give to the young science writers out there?
Yeah, it sure helps to be on the East Coast time zone, because the sooner you get something out, the better. I was always trying to get something written you know, by 10 in the morning, something like that, and get it finalized by 11 when the NHC 11 o'clock advisory comes out. You just change a few numbers and boom, try and get that up right then. That's typically when you're talking hurricanes, when the maximum people are there, you know, making hits on the web, they want to see something right when that 11 a.m. advisory comes in. So I would always try and get something out, you know, within an hour of when that 11 a.m. National Hurricane Center advisory would come out.
Thanks, Jeff.
Bill, last thought or question?
I'm still reveling in your pristine memory of your Hurricane Hugo flight. It was quite something. I really appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah, that was amazing. And Peter Black is sharing. We've got a whole row of comments, so you should go on afterwards and read what Peter had to say, his thoughts on it as well, saying that the crosswind on the landing was almost as scary as the ups and downs in the hurricane itself.
Okay.
So, guys, thank you. Great program today. Just terrific. And, Jeff, we appreciate you taking time to be with us and all the warm-up that led up to it and the conversation. Good stuff. Thank you, Jeff.
All right, Tim. You're welcome.
Al, good to have you as always, buddy. Great questions as well. And Bill, thank you for your insight and your expertise. We appreciate that. I want to thank all our sponsors who make this event a possibility each and every week at 10 a.m. USAA, the South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau. Those are our two big sponsors that are here year in and year out. We hope to see you back in person on South Padre Island again in April of 2023. The Weather Company, the City of Brownsville, all sponsors. Weather Boy, he's been busy with the big waves in Hawaii recently, covering those giant waves coming across the South Coast. There. Black Magic, Port of Brownsville, Walmart, all part of this program. That's it for today. Next week, we've got another great program coming up. Lowe's. David Venable will be here from Lowe's to talk about what they do before, during, and after a storm, and how they get ready for the storms and what happens and how they prepare. And it'll be some good information for us as well. So once again, gentlemen, thank you. Alex, thanks for back at headquarters. We'll see you guys next week, next Wednesday, 10 a.m. Until then, have a great week.
Loved what you've heard on this week's episode? Well, the answer is simple. It would mean the world to us if you could head over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review and feedback. Spreading the word really is the best way to grow our podcast and achieve even greater things. Thank you.